You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 1st, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Slate Justice and Courts reporter Mark Joseph Stern on the pain of a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Trump's CFO surrenders to face criminal charges. And Donald Rumsfeld, famous for killing hundreds of thousands of innocent people by lying the U.S. into a war, has died. Meanwhile, Kevin McCarthy threatens any Republican caucus member who attempts to sit on the January 6th commission. An Exxon lobbyist caught on tape lists his Senate allies blocking climate legislation. Half of them are Democrats. The Pacific Northwest heat wave, not just coincidentally, may have killed hundreds of people. And this late-breaking Supreme Court ruling, the conservative majority takes another chunk out of the Voting Rights Act, putting more pressure on the need to pass some voter protection in the Senate and the House. Revised New York City mayor race numbers has Adams with a slight lead. Meanwhile, Amazon complains that the new FTC chair, Lina Khan, has studied too much antitrust law. And lastly, Donald Trump rejects Ron DeSantis' plea to postpone his Florida rally as they are still digging bodies out of the Surfside wreckage. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Thursday. Emma is out until Tuesday on vacation. We're all going to be out on Monday. We're going to run a repeat for you. You will enjoy. You will enjoy. And but Emma's on a much needed, well-deserved vacation. I am here with you today. And let's get right into this. I'll have a lot more to say. I'm the fun half. Matt Bender is going to come in. Brandon Sutton, Matt Leck will be here. I'll have more to say about this tomorrow. But Donald Rumsfeld died, and the timing is a little bit off. Had he died 25 years ago, let's say, there would be hundreds of thousands of people, more than likely, alive at this point. There would be maybe millions of fewer refugees who had left Iraq, millions who had not moved within Iraq, fleeing their area that they lived. And like I say, by anybody's counts, even the U.S. government's counts, there would be hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians still alive today had Donald Rumsfeld departed this life earlier. He did not, and we did have a war that we were lied into by Donald Rumsfeld, was one of those key liars and architects of that. We did have hundreds of thousands of innocents dead. We have ongoing problems in that region, and we also initiated a torture regime that the vestiges of which remain in Guantanamo Bay to this day. So Donald Rumsfeld leaves with hopefully that something to that effect will be put on his tombstone. I doubt it will be. He didn't seem to have even the slightest bit of remorse. He seemed to enjoy it. That was my sense and watching him in real time. Here's a segment of him recalling that moment that he had given Saddam Hussein chemical weapons in their war with Iran.
Well, let me take you back about 20 years ago. The date, I believe, was in December 20th, 1983. You were meeting with Saddam Hussein. I think we have some video of that. Of that meeting. Tell me what was going on during this meeting.
Where did you get this video? From the Iraqi television?
This is from Iraqi television.
When did they give it to you? Recently or back then?
We've dug this out of the CNN library.
I see. Isn't that interesting? There I am.
Yeah, there he is. I mean, at that time he was giving weapons, chemical weapons, to Saddam Hussein to fight against the Iranians. Horrible, horrible weapons. There, of course, were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq any more so than cannons or guns are weapons of mass destruction. They stretched the definition of what weapons of mass destruction were. Then they claimed that they were moved to Syria. They claimed that they were hiding in bunkers. They were lying the whole time. Every single proclamation they made that was definitive was, in fact, definitionally a lie. This was information that was more or less readily available. We had weapons inspectors on the ground, but the hunger for war in this country was so great that we literally kicked the weapons inspectors out so that we could start to bomb because they weren't finding anything. So rest in whatever the opposite of peace is to Donald Rumsfeld, who passed away today. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mark Joseph Stern. We're only going to be talking about the Supreme Court cases that were announced last week. I will give you an update on the ones that are being announced this morning right after we talk to Mark Joseph Stern, right after this. Hey, folks, today's program sponsored in part by BetterHelp Online Counseling, who is giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. I know this firsthand. A lot of therapists all over, particularly right now, have long wait lists. It can take up to weeks, sometimes months, before they can see you. Well, when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. You'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. They have access to therapists all around the country. COVID, obviously, the pandemic, a crap show in many respects. Sort of like the wake of it is almost, for a lot of people, I don't know about the majority, I haven't seen any stats on this, but even more stressful. Sort of like rejoining, I don't know, returning to normalcy. The concept of like we went through this very traumatic thing and what do we get at the end of it? Just what, you know, more or less what we had before, maybe a little bit less. It's like usually when you go through a trauma like this, you're like, oh, I'm going to get a reward for making it through. In this instance, yeah, congratulations. You're back to your like, yeah, if you're lucky, B+ life. Anyways. Once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason for no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. They have therapists with specialties that may not be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you'd find through traditional means. You don't need to have insurance to use BetterHelp. Of course, they accept it. And they also have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's betterhelp.com/majority report. You can find the URL in your video description if you're watching this on YouTube or in our podcast description if you're listening. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member of the Majority Report, you not only get the you not only support the free show, but you get the free show free of commercials, and you get extra content every day with the fun half. Plus, I mean, I guess theoretically, if you didn't, you're not a member, of course you can buy the merch. But it doesn't mean as much, I would imagine. It's a little bit more of a hollow gesture. People are buying these, what do you call it? What are those? What are the suns out, guns out?
The tank tops?
Yeah, the tank tops. I don't know the latest tallies, but last I checked, we are 54. If it gets to 100, I'm wearing one of the tank tops on a Friday fun half. Maybe I'll do it on another fun half day.
That'll take your B plus up to an A minus.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to take a lot of other people's B plus to an A minus. But I got to start lifting weights. Because you know that's going to be the problem.
Well, now that people have seen your calves, expectations are through the roof.
I may just wear it actually instead of shorts because the calves are much better than the arms. I can tell you that right now. Anyways, shop.majorityreportradio.com for merchandise. We also got the Steven Crowder quote, "Oh no, Sam Cedar, what an effing nightmare" shirt, which is flying like it's going like hotcakes. Limited run for that one. We got to wait for the next time that we bomb a debate. But check it out. Remember, it's your support that makes this show possible. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Okay, now that interview with Mark Joseph Stern. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report joining us. Welcome. I want to welcome back to the program Mark Joseph Stern. He is a staff writer at Slate who writes about the courts and the law. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. I know we should say we are pre-taping this last night because as people are seeing this live, you are anticipating the final two decisions of the Supreme Court in this term, Brnovich versus DNC, which is a voting rights case that it's, I believe, out of Colorado, if I'm not mistaken.
Arizona.
And AFP versus Bonta, that is about disclosure of money, both of which are hugely important. And we will be talking about those in the following week. As we get those decisions. But there have been three or four in particular cases over the past week or two, I guess, a little less, that have been decided by the court that are going to have implications, I think, for years to come. Let's start with Cedar Point Nursery versus Hasid. Tell us the facts in that case.
Yeah, so this is a case about a California law that has been on the books for many decades and was the culmination of Cesar Chavez's labor organizing in California. Specifically allows union organizers and union advocates to go on to farms, commercial farms in California for up to 3 hours a day during non-working hours for a total of 120 days a year. And let's be clear, we're talking about an hour at lunch break or an hour when almost everybody is done working. Like, this is not really intrusive for business owners. And the reason this law exists is that a lot of California's agricultural workers are abused and exploited. And a lot of them don't speak English, are migrants or undocumented immigrants. They travel from place to place looking for work. And if union organizers can't reach them at work, they can't reach them at all. So this law has been a
also very often these people live on the farm itself. So these places function both as their place of work, but also their temporary residence.
And even those who don't live on the farm often live close by, and the farm will actually pay contractors to bus them back and forth from their home to the farm. So they are not available outside of work, which is a huge problem, because if they want to organize collectively and say, stop abusing us, they really need a union. And if the union can't access them at work, again, they're just not going to be able to access them at all. So the question here is whether this law that lets union organizers access these farms for a limited period constitutes a taking under the Constitution. And that's kind of a weird question, because when we think about a taking, it's usually like eminent domain, like the government has to build a road where your house is, or like a railroad where your business is. It's not usually a person stepping on someone's property. In fact, that's never before been considered a taking by the Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court considered this law many decades ago, it said that there was not even a real conflict, that there was no legitimate constitutional question here. But the Supreme Court has changed since then. And by a 6-3 vote, this Supreme Court held that union organizers stepping on the property of a business is a taking under the Constitution, and that every time it happens, the state or the union has to compensate the business owner for invading their own private property.
Just the idea of the remedy or the addressing of the taking shows how ridiculous this is, because what is the cost associated with a farm with someone stepping on the property? Does it go up if they take two steps into the property? Is it more expensive if two people walk on? Is it more expensive if the person who walks onto the property is heavier than another person? Like, how do you like establish, how could it be a taking if there's no value that's diminished from a farmer or a big ag company? And how do you establish like what the compensation would be?
So that's a great question. And I think one clue here is the fact that the plaintiffs in this case, the big ag businesses that brought this case, they didn't even ask for compensation. They just asked for an injunction that will block these union organizers from stepping on their property, period. And so I think what that shows is that they're not really after compensation. They understand that it's almost like a metaphysical question of what the cost is of a person on your property. They just want to force these union organizers to stay off their farms. They want to either bankrupt the unions or the state by forcing them to pay a ton of money, or I think more reasonably, just secure a court order that says you're not allowed on here. And at the end of the day, their actual desire for compensation themselves doesn't seem to exist. This is about sticking it to unions.
But I mean, did the court come up with a formula to, I mean, it, like, because they've created, it seems to me, like my understanding of the court in the past has been, regardless of how the outcome of the decision is that often what they want to do is resolve questions rather than create new ones. Because this seems to me, every single instance of someone walking onto a farm to go and unionize ag workers, there's going to have to be a new court case to determine how you calculate the cost of this taking.
Right. And so that's why, again, I think maybe the real goal here is to make unions in the state give up, to just make them empty their coffers in lawyers' fees trying to figure this out. But, you know, when you read the Chief Justice's opinion, he wrote the majority opinion here for all six conservatives. It's a little odd because you're reading him saying that this is a taking, that it's invasion of property, okay, whatever. And then you get to the end where you expect him to explain what value is detracted from the land. You know, what, how you calculate or compensate an owner for what's going on here. And instead, the opinion just ends and he just sends the case back down. He doesn't even address that. And so it seems like Roberts understands what the plaintiffs understood, which is that the overarching goal of this case is not to secure pennies from union organizers or the state. The goal is to make this scheme so unworkable and so confusing and so caught up in the courts that it just collapses and California eventually repeals the law.
So what was the theory about passing the law? I understand why California passed the law, and that is because they feel that workers have a right to unionize. But is there also like a state, is there a societal benefit? Because what I'm getting at here is like, where does this lead? Aside from the fact that it seems to be just a roadblock to allow people to organize and to weaken unions. And that is done by really, in some ways, like leveraging the fact that the court didn't address even in a formula as to how you would figure out how, like what this, like a taking is, right? Like, I mean, a traditional taking is, we are seizing this property. And how much is this property worth? Well, we can bring in real estate agents to tell us what this would go for in this locality. Or, I mean, there's an existing mechanism to put a price on that. There is no price on trespass and going in a union. I mean, I don't even know how you would calculate that, frankly. But my point is that, like, if it is not allowing the state to say that we perceive a benefit to society to allow these workers to not be exploited, to form a union, what's the limiting principle there as to what a state can do if it is a physical property right that is being I'm being diminished with a property right because of this state regulation? What regulation wouldn't be a taking?
Yeah, so I think that's the right question to ask. And the answer is pretty alarming. Justice Breyer and his dissent asked the same question, and he points to all of these laws that states have passed that allow individuals to trespass or invade private property, usually commercial businesses, for various inspections. Think of basic health and safety inspections. You know, the state often sends its own agents into businesses to make sure they're following the rules. But the reality is that sometimes the state also contracts with private companies, kind of like the way that the California delegated this to unions. It's not always state actors who are doing this. There are private companies that work for the state to conduct various inspections, from meatpacking plants to private schools and everything in between. And so the question now is, well, are those takings as well? When the state forces, you know, commercial businesses to let inspectors, whether they're state agents or contractors, enter their property, is that also a taking that requires compensation? And, you know, the majority, through Chief Justice Roberts, it doesn't really have a good answer. I honestly think that the answer boils down to, we hate unions so much that we're going to create a special rule that applies only to them. I mean, you see Roberts carving out these exceptions. Oh, well, health inspections are different. You know, commercial businesses are different from ag businesses. But I think it's all smoke and mirrors. I really think this is like the Janus decision 3 years ago, where the Supreme Court just carved out this weird rule that hobbles unions and then basically said, just to be clear, this doesn't apply to anybody else. We're only talking about unions because we really hate them.
But is there a possibility that, let's say, okay, I mean, when all of a sudden it becomes, well, it's 6-3 now, but maybe it becomes 7-2 because we know how loath Justice Breyer is to the idea that he would even have any consciousness about, it's absurd that a Supreme Court justice would have any consciousness of the implication of maybe that they would die in while they're on the court. But be that as it may, what's to prevent a majority of 5 out of 7, let's say, or 6 for that matter, to say, like, well, actually, there's a lot of stuff here that is going to formulate our opinions in the future as to whether government can do these regulations, because if they can't enforce them, what's the point of the regulation? Or this sign that they've told us, employees must wash their hands before they go out, like that. That's a taking. I mean, I've got to put a sign in my my studio about the rights that my employees have. That's literally taking real estate in my office. I want to hang up my many awards on that wall, and I can't now because I've got to put up that sign. Like what? Like it feels like this is a building block for something really horrible in the future.
Yeah. And how about a civil rights law that says you have to allow Black people to enter your business? Is every Black person who enters your business a taking that the state enforces that then the state has to pay you for? Does the state have to pay businesses for complying with the law? I think, again, the answer is it just depends on what the court does next. This time around, Roberts did all this hand waving where he said, we're not talking about anything else. We're just talking about unions and, you know, California California farms. But again, these questions are the right ones. And I do think, especially looking at some of these radical lower court judges, right, I think that SCOTUS has handed them a weapon to use against all manner of regulations, not just health and safety laws, but civil rights laws and all the stuff you were just discussing, to say, oh, well, according to Cedar Point, this is a taking. You know, the Supreme Court didn't say it, but we're just extending its logic to where it should go. And that really frightens me, because I do think that the Supreme Court's conservatives understand that these lower courts are packed with radical Trump nominees. They understand that what they hint at in their own majority opinions will be seized upon and expanded by the radical lower courts. So it will be a problem for other states. We will be seeing conservative law firms bringing a raft of new lawsuits that claim that all kinds of very, very minor burdens on businesses are takings, and really trying to kind of dismantle the operation of the law as we know it by forcing states to pay untold sums just to make businesses comply with statutes.
That's a massive, an important point for people to understand, the way that these Supreme Court decisions, even if they say it only applies to this case. I know that Bush v. Gore, which was supposedly supposed to be, you know, sui generis and not to be cited, has been cited many, many times on a circuit court level, on a district court level. And so you could have entire regions of the country who are operating under a very restrictive set of restrictions on what states can do in terms of providing regulations for businesses. It seems extraordinary to me. But let's move on to another case that has, I think, other implications in terms of like people's access to courts. This is TransUnion versus Ramirez. Tell us the facts in that case.
And such an important point that this case really is about access to justice. It's wrapped up in some kind of technical legalese that can be difficult for people to understand. But this is about Congress's ability to create and enforce rights, an ability that I think the court basically took away in TransUnion. So backing up, Congress a long time ago passed a law that said that credit reporting agencies have to put all of these processes in place before labeling somebody a criminal or a terrorist, because there's laws against extending credit to people who are criminals or terrorists. So these reporting agencies want to, you know, label those individuals so that they can say, oh, well, we warned you. But they're really bad at it. No surprise if you've ever dealt with a credit agency. They are really terrible at figuring out who is a terrorist or a criminal, and labeled thousands and thousands and thousands of people terrorists and criminals when they were no such thing, just because they happened to share a first and last name with someone who was. And according to Congress, if these agencies labeled you as a terrorist or a criminal, you could go to court, to a federal court, and sue them and collect damages. And that's exactly what thousands of people did. They discovered that TransUnion had called them terrorists or criminals. They discovered that TransUnion had failed to comply with all of these basic processes to keep that from happening. And they sued TransUnion and said, you violated our rights. And the Supreme Court threw out their case. And I think it's really important to focus on exactly what the Supreme Court did here. The court didn't say that TransUnion had complied with the law. The court didn't even pretend that there was any argument that TransUnion complied with the law. The court admitted that TransUnion broke the law. But what the court said was that in its view, in the view of five justices on the Supreme Court, Congress was wrong to say that you are harmed when a credit reporting agency calls you a terrorist, that that is not a real harm, and that it is the job of five justices on the Supreme Court, not Congress, to decide what counts as real harm. And because the justices disagreed with Congress's determination that that was harm, they threw out the case and said that all of those individuals who were labeled terrorists don't have a right to sue in federal court. And what that means at bottom is that the court said Congress does not have authority to create new rights by statute and does not have authority to open the federal courthouse doors to victims, to individuals whose rights as defined by Congress were violated.
Okay, so this is this is so jam-packed with problems. Yeah. Here. And we should say that, you know, the idea here is that there were people who were on this list who were labeled by the credit agencies, and some of them had their loans rejected, or they couldn't rent a place, or, you know, whatever it was that being on this list prohibits you from doing. Other people had yet to find out that they were going to be denied a car loan or, you know, a rental or whatnot. And it's that set of people that the court says you have no damages here, even though there's been a statutory rule that says that just being on that list is in and of itself a damage, because Congress wants to make sure that these companies that have deal with a tremendous amount of sensitive information are doing it in a responsible way. So the first thing is that there's two, it seems to me there's two different sort of levels in which you can look at this. This is the structural question of how the court's relationship with Congress. And then there's also just the absurd notion that these credit agencies exist not to create lists, but to use the information. So this information ultimately is going to be used. And the idea that you have to wait for the harm to exist, and then you as an individual have to go sue TransUnion, you're not going to do that, because it's going to cost you a tremendous amount of money and time. It could take you 2 or 3 years to sue TransUnion at that point to get off this list. And you can't get your car. You can't rent a place. You can't buy a home, whatever it is. So there's that narrow problem with it. But this other part where Congress doesn't have the ability to create a right, that seems to diminish Congress's power. And also, what happened to the whole activist judges thing?
Right. So this case is really interesting, because Justice Clarence Thomas peeled off from the conservatives, the other conservatives, and dissented along with the liberals. And I think it's worth highlighting here, this is the impact of a 6-3 conservative majority, right? Even if one conservative justice peels off from the pack, the case will still come out the same way. It will still be a conservative decision, because the deck is so stacked with these conservatives. And so Clarence Thomas dissented. It didn't make a difference, but I think his dissent is really absolutely correct top to bottom. He makes the points that you just made. He says, how could it be that having this time bomb in this, in someone's computer, in someone's file drawer, there is a time bomb for thousands of people who are about to walk into a car dealership and discover that they are not able to get credit, but they can't actually sue until they're turned away, which is just totally contrary to what Congress wanted. Congress wanted there to be responsible reporting on the back end of this stuff. But looking at the bigger picture, this notion that Congress can't create rights, if that is true, then Congress has been violating the Constitution since 1789, because the very first Congress created rights outside of what courts had acknowledged, gave people the right to enforce them. And ever since then, Congress has been doing the exact same thing. What Brett Kavanaugh, who wrote the majority opinion here, did was sort of overturn 200 plus years of history in favor of this abstract idea that only federal judges get to decide what counts as harm, that only federal judges get to decide what counts as an injury, that the decision, again, of five justices should override the decision of Congress and the president when they're passing a law. And that is such outrageous judicial supremacy. I mean, it takes a doctrine that's supposed to be about judicial modesty and uses it to just turbocharge the justices' power and the federal court's power to override Congress and the people's representatives. It's a totally backwards use of standing doctrine. And I really think Clarence Thomas has it right. And when Clarence Thomas is the rational one, that this court is in trouble.
How could Congress pass a law that says, we need to protect the privacy of American citizens? So these credit agencies cannot use, this bit of information. They can't use the Social Security a number, or they can't use, could Congress do that? I mean, there'd be no mechanism to enforce it at that point if it's a civil law, would there be, until somebody finds out that they have, because TransUnion, if Congress said tomorrow, you cannot collect Social Security numbers, TransUnion did, they collected them. They said, well, we haven't done anything that cost anybody yet. There's no remedy for that.
Correct. I think that the Supreme Court would say that the victims of that misdeed could not sue in federal court, that they were not harmed. They never experienced an injury. The only injury was on the back end. And so they do not have any right to go into federal court. Congress tried to allow for them. Basically what happened in a previous case called Spokio, where the court hinted at what it did in TransUnion, but didn't have the votes yet. They were waiting basically on Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, where the court said, you know, yeah, this company was collecting all of this data illegally. It violated this law that Congress passed, but we're not really sure that people have standing because they didn't know about it. They weren't injured. So it's just too damn bad.
Wow. That's nuts. And we should also say it's just one more example of closing the courthouse door, because it sets up all these obstacles that make it impossible for people to pursue a claim. You lose the entire power of class action lawsuits to change the behavior of companies that are acting outside the bounds of law or outside the bounds of what society wants at that point. Because you could say the courts are responsible for determining whether there's been an injury here, but they'll never get to assess that if you can't afford to bring a lawsuit.
Right. And if you can't band together with people who experienced a similar injury and all sue collectively, because the damages in this case individually were not that much. $2,000. No reasonable person is going to sue for $2,000. But if you can find 5,000 other people who experienced the same injury, which is how these cases always work, then you can, you know, reasonably bring a case and expect to get some money out of it. But this Supreme Court hates class actions. It hates the idea of people suing collectively. It thinks that that's an egregious abuse of the court system. And so I do think that this is another example of the court creating these new doctrines and new theories for the very obvious purpose of tamping down and busting up class actions around the country.
Right. I mean, this is reminiscent of AT&T and Concepcion. The one where you had AT&T overcharging, I think, hundreds of thousands of customers, like $3 a month. Nobody's going to go sue AT&T for $36 a year. It's just you can't, and no lawyer is going to take that case because it's just not worth the amount of work that you would have to do involved. But there's no way to inhibit AT&T from, like, oh, we made a mistake. We overcharged 300,000 people, that's a lot of money for them. And there's no disincentive or remedy to stop them from doing it, it feels like, at this point.
Right. And what the court said was it was perfectly fine for AT&T to put in their contract in tiny print at the very bottom, by the way, by using our service, you agree never to join a class action or even never to sue at all. That's the mandatory arbitration cases. You know, most of us using our phones, using our computers, we are surrendering our right to sue for any reason ever in any court. All of those cases have to go individually to an arbitrator, usually before someone who was chosen by the corporation, by not a judge, but someone who, you know, again, is biased toward the corporation, usually in Delaware. So that, I mean, it's so perverted how this Supreme Court has been able to single-handedly, acting by itself, deprive us of really basic rights like access to justice that we had thought were secure for, like, really the first 200 years of the American experience.
So let's turn to Collins v. Yellen. This is a case that has maybe some short-term reason to celebrate, but long-term could be highly problematic. Tell us about this case.
Yeah, so this is a case that is a sequel to last year's CELA law decision, where the Supreme Court held that the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau can be fired at will by the president. Now, remember, when Congress created the CFPB, the whole deal was we need this to be independent. Like, we don't want the president to be able to interfere with the CFPB. But the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, said, actually, we believe in the unitary executive theory that the president gets to fire anyone he wants within the executive branch. So we're not going to allow the CFPB director to be insulated from the president. Now, I think that was a really bad, wrong, stupid decision, but it did kind of pay off for liberals on January 20th when Biden fired Trump's CFPB director immediately, like during his inauguration and replaced her with a liberal. That was a sort of good result from a bad decision. And I think Collins v. Yellen is a similar situation. So here we have another federal agency that is led by a single person. It's called the Federal Housing Finance Agency. And this is the agency that started regulating Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac after the bailout. It's kind of like a twin to the CFPB. And it holds Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at something called a conservatorship, which basically means that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have to give all of their money, all of their net income to the government. In exchange for the massive bailout that it received back in 2008, which seems like a fair deal to me. Anyway, it's led by a single director, and the Supreme Court in Collins v. Yellen said, this too is unconstitutional. We cannot have federal agencies that are led by a single director who is shielded from termination by the president. Because this director is shielded from removal by the president, this is all unconstitutional. We're just going to fix the problem by giving the president this new power to fire the director of this agency, which is exactly what President Joe Biden did after the decision came down and once again replaced the Trump holdover with another liberal.
And the idea was that those seeking redress wanted to say that the decision to put them in conservatorship and to inhibit shareholders from getting this money was inappropriate because of the way that the law was set up, that he was non-fireable. And the court just said the fact that this guy was or was not fireable had no bearing on the validity of what decisions they made when they were hired or after they were hired.
Right. So the irony of this case, as you just explained, is that the shareholders filed suit because they wanted to blow up the FHFA. They wanted to end this conservatorship of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They wanted to force the government to put back about $140 billion into those companies, which would then go back to their, some of it would go back to their own pockets, right? Because they are investors in the companies. And their goal was to sort of blow up the housing market. And instead, what the Supreme Court did was say, actually, just because this guy can't be fired doesn't mean that everything he did was illegal. In fact, we don't think that anything he did was illegal. So we're going to let Biden replace him with a liberal, but we're not going to give the shareholders a dime, which means that these shareholders who are conservatives who wanted to blow up this agency ended up handing the keys to the agency over to Joe Biden, who will now be keeping Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on an even tighter leash than they were before.
So with all that said, let's do a hypothetical. This seems completely far-fetched, but can you imagine that after Joe Biden, you might get some really aggressively pro-business, let's say, or pro-banking president who might turn around and fire the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because they are cracking down on banks too much, or payday lenders or something like that, or we're going to, we're going to unleash Fannie and Freddie and maybe in some ways, you know, allow them to backstop some very bad loans and create another financial crisis. I mean, I know that is fantastical, the notion that you could have a president come in who would be that irresponsible, but on day one would just simply do that. But that's the problem here, right?
Yes, that's exactly the problem. And, you know, going beyond these two agencies, there's a lot of language in the court's decisions in these cases that suggests they're not only going to go after these single director agencies, that they're also going to go after agencies like the Federal Reserve and the FCC and the FTC that have historically been independent from the president for good reason, because we don't want partisan interference in the Federal Reserve. We don't want a massive economic shift in policy every time a new president comes in, or, you know, a president decides to lose his mind and stack a bunch of gold bugs onto the Federal Reserve. But with these decisions, I think the court has really effectively laid the groundwork for the next president to come in and not only fire the head of the CFPB and the FHFA, but also a lot of these other historically independent agencies that regulate the U.S. economy that were supposed to be independent to keep everything stable. I strongly suspect that, like, President Josh Hawley or President Tom Cotton are going to come in on day one and say, screw this, we're firing everyone, independent or not. The Supreme Court gave us the keys to the castle.
Yes, and I think DeSantis, President DeSantis, would do that as well. But it seems to me when you look at this, and you could even go back to the 2013 essentially, you know, gutting of the Voting Rights Act. For a conservative judicial movement that has spent so much time pretending this is about judicial activism, which is, you know, defined in their terms, the idea that, you know, at the very least, that if Congress has spoken out about something, that you must respect it. Like, there is no room for the judiciary, except in those rare occasions where Congress passes something that is unconstitutional in some fashion. But generally, you defer if Congress has addressed it. The Congress set up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in this way. Congress set up the FHFA in this way. This is all they reauthorized the Voting Rights Act. They determined that these credit unions, these credit reporting agencies are, you know, are dealing with such sensitive information. You're dealing with the privacy of Americans that Congress says, we're going to make some bright lines and you can't cross these, even if there's no provable damage in that very moment. It's a damage in and of itself. Like, we say that there's privacy rights. The court is rejecting all of, like, it seems to me, Congress's authority. And we're going to see it in terms of their ability to delegate things too, to agencies or to other institutions, and say, like, we've decided this is the way it's going to work. And this is just coming down to literally five or six people who are going to determine, we know better how all of these things should work, not just in the absence of Congress addressing it, despite the fact that Congress has addressed it.
Yeah, and that's the sad irony of really all the opinions we've talked about today. You know, the court accuses Congress of violating the separation of powers, but does not consider the possibility that the court itself is violating the separation of powers by intervening in a dispute between Congress and the executive, or Congress and somebody else, and saying, we know the rules and you don't. We're going to tell you how this works. You don't get to make this decision. We do. And I think it goes to show that the concept of judicial restraint, I mean, it's really been tossed out the window by today's conservative legal movement. Judicial restraint came into vogue as a response to the Earl Warren Court, as a response to Brown versus Board of Education and all of the liberal decisions from the 50s and 60s, where conservative judges basically said, we're in the minority. We've got to sort of stem this tide by saying judges should be modest, judges should be restrained. But today, they've got the power. Conservatives have a six-justice majority on SCOTUS. They've got majorities on most of the courts of appeals in this country. And they've decided, why should we hold ourselves back? Why should we limit our imagination based on some abstract principle like judicial restraint? The truth is that as soon as they got in the driver's seat, they went up to 100 miles an hour. And I really don't expect them to stop, because frankly, I don't see the kind of backlash among the public that I think we would need to see to really scare the Supreme Court out of doing what it's doing.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's part of the reason why I wanted you on the show today to talk about this. We should also say, you mentioned the Warren Court. The Roberts Court has existed now longer than the Warren Court did, I believe. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Roberts may be younger. Certainly, these other justices are younger by decades relative to what to the justices that consisted of the Warren Court. Like, this is, we're going to go through this era. We you know, people in your profession still talk about the Warren Court. The Roberts Court is going to dictate the trajectory of this country for decades. Decades upon decades, it seems to me. And they're just constructing the trajectory. We're not even living the trajectory yet.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so ridiculous to see these opinion pieces that say, oh, the Supreme Court's surprisingly moderate. The Supreme Court's not as conservative as we thought. They are just beginning. Like, they are just putting the pieces into place. Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh are still going to be on that court in the 2050s. A lot of Trump's judicial nominees will still be active judges through the 2060s. They were put on there when they were 33 or 34. They're going to be there there for the rest of our lives. And they are only just beginning to, as you said, kind of put into place the trajectory of the conservative legal revolution. So to take a few data points from this term alone and say, oh, well, Amy Coney Barrett didn't go as crazy as she could have, so this must prove she's a closet liberal. That is just, that fundamentally misunderstands the game that the conservative legal movement is playing here.
And I think that's a charitable estimation of what's going on with that. There's a lot of people who have a vested interest in maintaining a good relationship with the conservatives in the judiciary. I mean, because they're going to go in front of those cases, or they want to place students in clerkships under these judges, which enhances their career at you know, as in law school professors. I mean, there's a lot of that. All right, so let's just look at the eviction moratorium, because this is one of those things that people are like, well, look, see how maybe not so harsh, but the implications of this, they're going to have real impact on people in the short term, but there's no structural issues that are being dealt with down the road for this, are there?
Well, so to back up, the eviction moratorium is currently in place because of a CDC order that is rests on this really broad grant of power by Congress. Congress said, look, when there's a public health crisis, the CDC can do a bunch of stuff, a bunch of regulations that it couldn't normally do. And one of those the CDC has decided is to pause evictions, to say you got to let people stay in their houses. There's a pandemic. This has been extended through July 31st by the Biden administration. But on Wednesday, the Supreme Court, or on Tuesday, the Supreme Court said by a 5-4 vote that it could stay in place through July 31st, but it could not be extended any further, and that it actually is illegal, but the court's going to let it be wound down so it doesn't create chaos. This is something Justice Brett Kavanaugh said. He wrote separately to say, I'm not going to side with the other conservatives because Barrett, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch would have ended it immediately. But Brett Kavanaugh comes in and says, I'm not going to end it right now, but I want you to know, CDC, that I think this is illegal. And if you try to extend it one more day, I'm going to step in and block it. And if you try to revive it, if the pandemic gets worse again, I'm also going to block it. And that's such a weird kind of relation between the branches of government, for the Supreme Court to act like a babysitter and say, you know, CDC, I know that you're being naughty. I'll let you keep being naughty for a little while. But if you push the limits, then I'm really going to come crashing down on you. I don't think that's how judging normally works.
So in other words, we're not a nation of laws. We're a nation of ask the moms.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think Kavanaugh knew he would get like good press from writing this, from saying, I'll let the moratorium stay in place. I think he's pretty press savvy. But, you know, like at the end of the day, he's also telling the Biden administration, you don't get to go any further than you already have. I'm the boss. I'm the mom, which, again, is just like a very weird way to run a court, in my view.
And it's also another instance where they're saying that Congress does not have the authority to suspend, I guess, this private debt collection in a state of emergency of some sort.
Yeah. So Kavanaugh flirts with the idea that Congress could pass like an entirely new statute to like reauthorize an eviction moratorium in the future. But I really suspect that if Congress tried to do that, that the court would step in and say, actually, you're delegating too much power. You're trampling on states' rights. You know, we let you do this the first time, but we're not going to let you get away with it again.
Really disturbing. I don't know. Should we talk about the cursing cheerleader better? But I mean, it's fascinating because I think, you know, you make this point about the public does not respond to the cases that we've just outlined that are going to have a dramatic impact on people's daily lives in ways that they can't even imagine and will probably be obscured from them.
Right.
You know, I mean, nobody's going to go like, wait a second, I can't get this car loan because TransUnion put me on this list. And Congress doesn't have the ability to restrict that. And I'm not going to get this car loan. And I'm going to spend the next 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, year, 2 years trying to fight this. They're not going to look back and go like, oh, well, it was TransUnion versus Ramirez. Because we have, it seems to me, an entire body politic, and I include the media in this, who either are willfully ignorant about this stuff or just don't perceive the ideology that is embedded in decisions like this.
Right. I mean, there's so much going on here. And I think you identified some of it when you noted that, like, the legal elites have a vested interest in not revealing to the public just how partisan and just how ideological a lot of these decisions are. I also think, you know, as I said before, like, there's so much legalese here, and the court tries to make it even more confusing and incoherent. I really do think that sometimes the Supreme Court makes decisions more complicated than they need to be, so that the average person who doesn't have a law degree can't pick it up and understand. And I also think the media does not connect the dots from A to B and does not explain to people, you know, you are not able to exercise this right specifically because of this Supreme Court decision. There's actually an analogy to climate change here, you know, how the media often doesn't say, you know, these wildfires are due to climate change. They just happen and we report on them. There's a similar thing when awful stuff happens in this country and it can be attributed to court decisions. I mean, we've had mass shootings facilitated by court decisions blocking gun laws. And the media is too scared to say this is because this judge let this mass shooter buy this gun. There's too much fear to just pin down the actual proximate cause of really bad stuff that's going on, because it's wrapped in legalese, because it's kind of complicated, and because there's a taboo against blaming courts for the consequences of their own bad decisions.
Well, folks can find the cheerleader stuff there. I don't have such a cheery mood right now. But Mark Joseph Stern, thank you so much for your time today. Very helpful and interesting and scary. And I hope it adds to people's understanding of the implications of the courts.
It's very nice to talk to someone who actually gets it. So thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. And I should say that over the course of this morning, those two cases that Mark Joseph Stern referenced in terms of that we're facing the Supreme Court today, one being a Voting Rights Act question coming out of Arizona. There were two state laws that prohibited people who were not the person who filled out their absentee ballot for handing it in. So, for instance, either maybe you're homebound and you can't hand it in and you just filled it out. You want to meet the deadline. Somebody comes by to pick it up. Or what they call ballot harvesting, which, of course, is really just people who are picking up ballots that have been sealed and filled out and brought back in. I think some provisional balloting. The Supreme Court essentially ruled that they're going to ignore Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, or they're going to rewrite it. We will talk more in coming days about that ruling. Then in a separate ruling, which also just came down, this is the way they do it. Late June, early July is when a lot of the rulings are announced. 6-3 vote. Surprise, surprise. The Supreme Court, as they were looking, I believe the case is AFP, that's the Americans for Prosperity, versus California, although it may not be California. It could be the name of the Secretary of State there. Regardless, California had a law that required nonprofits to file a list of their donors if the donations were over $5,000 or represented 2% of the organization's total donations. The case was brought by the Americans for Prosperity Foundation, that is the Koch brothers. And it basically said, no, there's no obligation to disclose. If you go back to Citizens United, the whole argument that Anthony Kennedy had made was, well, at least we've got disclosure laws. And, of course, that never worked out. And so that's where we're at, folks. People have asked me in the past, why do you harp on the Supreme Court so much? Because of rulings like this and the series of rulings we're going to have going forward with a 6-3 court. That fluky one where that fifth vote could go the other direction, We don't have that luxury anymore. It's 6-3. We'll talk about these cases and more tomorrow. If you're watching us on Peacock, we will see you then. And if you're watching us here, I am going to step out. I should just say the reason why we started today early was not because we wanted to strike fear in the heart of Steven Crowder or of Dave Rubin or Ben Shapiro or of whomever.
Bongino.
No, it was because I've got to go get what do they call it? An endoscopy? Something? I have acid reflux, and so I've got to go get an endoscopy, and I can't eat now, which is really the toughest part. But Matt Binder can eat, and that's why he's here. Binder will be here, as will Brandon Sutton.
Did you see the new invention that people, you can put wires on your teeth with a magnet that keeps your top and bottom teeth wired together for exactly your situation where you're not allowed to eat? Medical thing. It seems like scientists going a little bit too far. But it's
so that you don't have to exercise any will? You have your jaw basically wired shut?
You literally can't do anything but a liquid, like a diet.
I'm not even allowed to have liquid right now.
Oof.
I couldn't. I can't even have a glass of water. Right.
Rough.
That's tough.
But when's the last time you ate?
I ate this morning like 15 minutes before I had to stop eating. So there it is.
That was a good move.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt. you can support this program by becoming a member and join the majorityreport.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Matt Binder, since you're here full of vim and verve today, dancing on the fact that I can't eat.
Were you gonna say pissing?
Right. I was gonna say pissing pig. I couldn't figure out what it was.
I gotta say that Just Coffee sounds delicious right now. I can't wait to pour myself a nice cup of
bastard. Look at you with the haircut. Very fancy.
Thank you. Thank you. That's what.
So, Matt, what's happening on Doom these days?
Well, tonight I will be walking at youtube.com/MattBinder and then later as a podcast at doomedcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. I will be walking through my recent piece about all of the cryptocurrency shady marketing schemes and outright scams that are currently perforating online among influencers. You've probably seen, especially if you're young, I'm sure your daughter has come across this, big influencers on social media, big YouTubers, live streamers in the video gaming world especially, have been hawking all of these highly volatile altcoins, alternative cryptocurrencies, to their fans. Their fans have been buying into it. And then once enough people buy into it, it seems like the common case here is all the big holders of these coins sell off. Classic pump and dump. Yep. Leaving all these young fans of these influencers left holding the bag. I will walk through what's going on here and show you some examples tonight at youtube.com/MattBinder.
A good friend of mine told me that her brother was walking his dog in L.A., at like one of the dog parks out there. And a dude who, like, he maybe had met briefly at the dog park came up and was like, I want to give you some crypto, and gave him some crypto. The guy turned around and sold it for like $100,000. And then the whole thing collapsed afterwards. It was just basically, it's unbelievable.
There's a famous Joseph Kennedy Sr. story about the Great Depression, which is that he was walking like in Manhattan or something like that, and somebody came up with a stock tip, and that's when he knew, like, oh, I need to sell, because if everybody just on the street is talking about this crap, it's definitely like smart money there.
Right. That tells you, big bubble.
Yeah, once the influencers are telling you about it online, that's the message to get out if you're in, and to not get in if you're out.
It is extraordinary. But what a great currency that would be.
Right. But right. Sam, didn't you hear that El Salvador adopted Bitcoin as one of its main currencies, an official currency? Obviously, that means it's the future. By the way, they're giving $30 in Bitcoin to every citizen of El Salvador to promote this, which sounds great until you find out that you can't actually exchange those $30 for real money if you're in El Salvador. You have to use them as Bitcoin. So if you're somewhere where they don't accept Bitcoin quite yet, or some other thing happens, like you don't have a phone to scan your Bitcoin transaction through, then you're out of luck. You know, that's not really helping you. Also, they have like a $150 million.
Yeah, I was going to ask about this. Is this $150 like 150 what million or... Yeah, it must be million, like fund that's basically just to wash Bitcoins, right? Like if you have a bunch of dirty Bitcoin, can you just cash it in? I can basically use that fund to... I don't understand this close enough, but that's what it seems like to me.
It's basically seems like a way for the government to quickly get the money to people who get Bitcoin and then want actual real physical money. Because in El Salvador, the only way to do that is to go to a Bitcoin ATM right now. And guess how many Bitcoin ATMs there are in all of El Salvador? 3.
Oh,
so,
that's pretty good.
Brandon Sutton, the host of The Discourse.
Hello, fam.
What's in your Bitcoin wallet?
I am, you know, I guess embarrassed to say that I don't understand things like Bitcoin and NFTs. So I've put all my money into Pokemon cards and other non-perishable goods. You know, things that appreciate over time, not things that, you know, eventually just disappear when we don't have electricity. And if, you know, in the future, in a post-apocalyptic society, all, you know, dealing is going to be done in like trading card games like Yu-Gi-Oh, Magic, you know, Pokemon. And I'm prepared for that. A lot of people aren't. A lot of people are like hoarding gold, useless. Yeah. It's useless. I will say, though, you know, honestly, when I was a kid, this is going to make me sound old. They used to warn us about strangers handing out drugs. And that was like the big thing that was going to get you in trouble. Now it's crypto. It's crazy. I would way rather someone hand my child a dime bag full of any drug they could think of rather than like, you know, a bunch of dog coin or poon coin, whatever the new Elon Musk thing is.
I think he's got baby dog coin or something like that now, right? Or isn't there like a...
Right, baby Doge. She tweeted about it this morning and he doubled its value in like an hour.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Just insane. All right. Well, Matt, do you want to get in? Matt's going to place a bid.
No. Left Reckoning is on vacation. Griscom is out camping in Colorado. So I might do a Twitch stream tonight or tomorrow, depending on if I have date night tonight. So
whoa. All right.
So, yeah, so twitch.tv/literary hangover. Check it out. And we'll be premiering a Milton Alamadi talk on Walter Rodney tonight on the Left Reckoning YouTube page. So check that out, folks.
Griscom's out mining tulips. He's going to... All right, folks. I leave you in good hands. A lot of material today. I already danced on Donald Rumsfeld's grave. I mean, I don't even get any joy that it is passed because he sort of escaped any accountability.
Are you
familiar
with TikTok challenges? They're like little dances set to parts of songs.
Am I familiar? Maybe I haven't shown you the one I did with Myla a couple years ago.
We should start choreographing like TikTok challenges to like both the Crowder song, I think, if you want to do that.
Oh, that would be great.
Or like just to like announcements like Rumsfeld's death. We could do a little TikTok dance to that.
Yeah, that would be something. And of course, you guys going to talk about, Meghan McCain. Just go around the horn right now. Odds that she's got her husband has some new like digital channel that she's going to be on or something to that effect.
I'm willing to do Hail Mary pass and that she's going to get a legitimate like columnist gig somewhere. you know, maybe not, maybe semi-regularly. I don't know. I mean, honestly, I think that she got tired.
The job where she's going to have to write something every week?
It sounds crazy. It sounds crazy. I know how crazy it sounds. But you know what? Stranger things have happened.
That would be strange. I mean, I guess maybe she could have somebody who would write it for her, but she does not strike me as somebody who is like, what I really want to do is stop all this, like, you know, celebrity stuff on The View, and I want to write something substantive every week. I would not.
But I like to take the long shot sometimes, Sam. I like to be the one on the fringes.
There you go. Well,
you know, I think you're automatically assuming she's going to write something substantive. You know, I mean, Barry Weiss's job doesn't seem all that hard. She could just go talk to some rich people at a college and talk about how terrible cancel culture is on the campus there.
As my dad used to say, and then that's the way she would start every column. What would dad think? What's your guess, Matt?
What are we guessing about, by the way? Just Megan.
what's her next career move?
Oh, I think she's going to defend her husband Ben Dominic as a POC, because Ben believes that because he has ancestors who colonized Cuba, that he is a person of color. So I think Megan is going to switch into that sort of lane.
Binder.
I don't know. Maybe she'll start a podcast.
There's no doubt she's going to start a podcast. That's part of the project. So I just said digital, some type of digital media that her husband's probably going to set up or something.
Wait, do we think she's leaving The View?
Yeah, she is leaving The View.
Oh, I didn't see that.
She self canceled. She got tired of them waiting for her, and she got tired of waiting for them to cancel her. So she just fired herself.
Did not think I was smart enough. I was canceled because people didn't take me seriously. I mean, she is going to. There, I haven't heard her goodbye tweet. You know, that's what I used to say with the blogger. Back when the bloggers, it was like so long, cruel world, or something like that. There was a specific meme essentially was, you know, goodbye, cruel world. One of those posts where they basically say, like, I'm not going to do this anymore, but it's your fault. So
she should just plagiarize what Barry Weiss said.
All right. To me, the more interesting thing isn't what Meghan McCain does next. The more interesting thing is who's going to be the next token conservative on The View.
You got any bets on that?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of... Who?
Kayleigh McEnany.
Well, I mean, yeah. I would say Rumsfeld, but he just died. So, you know, it seems like an even longer shot.
Well, Rumsfeld's ghost, maybe.
Right.
That would be awkward. That would change.
He
the
was
nature
a flirt,
of the view.
Apparently. What? Yeah,
that's right. I'd watch it though.
What's Megyn Kelly up to nowadays? Nothing. I could picture that.
Oh, that's true.
Good point, actually.
It's a good guess. Well, I guess we're all going to have to wait. This is such exciting content to debate as who's going to be the person on The View. All right, guys. Good luck. Have fun in the fun half. I will see you folks tomorrow, Friday. Bye bye.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money.
Hell of a lot of bank.
A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back.
And the Africans are black African.
And the alpha males are black.
And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on!
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.
Back.